Hello and welcome to Ride the Omnibus. I'm your host, Ariel Baska, and today I'll be discussing the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, with the creators behind it, producer Larissa Rhodes and director Jeff Orlowski. Their previous projects include the acclaimed documentary Chasing Coral and the Emmy-winning Chasing Ice, created through the production company Exposure Labs. I am so thrilled to have you both on this show. It is a real honor for me today.
Thank you so much, Ariel.
First of all, I'm completely bowled over that your documentary covers not just the technology side of things, but parenting, addiction, neurology, advertising, data collection, privacy concerns, news, mental health, political discourse, genocide, corporations, the polarization of global social systems, and you somehow managed to break all of that down concisely and with so much clarity that this message is breaking through and having a real impact on so many people who would never have understood the complexity and the interwoven nature of all these elements. So how'd you do it, man?
Awesome. Well, just the way you just summarized that, I was like, wow, we did cover a lot. I think that was one of the shocking things for us in pursuing this project, was realizing just how much our technology is affecting all aspects of society. And that was sort of the real realization for us. As you mentioned, Larissa and I worked on climate change projects in the past, and one of our subjects was referencing this as a climate change of culture. And I think when we heard that, it was, all right, well, you got us. This is now we see what's going on here. There's an invisible societal shift happening due to a breakdown of our information ecosystem. And I hadn't heard that phrase before working on this project. Just like climate change and fossil fuels are destroying our natural ecosystem, our technology platforms are destroying our information ecosystem. I think the helpful part was just looking at it from this singular lens, that the way this technology is designed is giving each and every one of us different customized information, giving us customized news. And the consequences of that seemingly innocent frame of personalization, like the consequences of personalization, are really, really dramatic when you extrapolate that over society and over many, many years. And so I think that's the quick answer to your question. But it was really, really hard for us to wrap our head around. I mean, Larissa and I, we spent countless times debating the issue. And I think that's something that I'm so thrilled with what our team was able to think through, because these are very, very complex issues. In many ways, I feel like we barely scratched the surface. There are so many issues that didn't make its way into the film, that we didn't fit, that we, in some cases, weren't even aware of at the time. There's a huge and vast conversation around this subject.
Yeah, we had an amazing team, as Jeff mentioned, our editor Davis and our writer Vicky, really trying to absorb the landscape and the industry and try to understand, you know, where is this breakdown of truth coming from? And the fact that it does affect every decision that we make, every action that we take, the beliefs that we hold, because these technologies are in the palm of our hand of billions of people around the world.
No, it's incredible. And I love that this connects to your previous perspectives in terms of your work with climate change and looking at it as another form of climate change within a different kind of ecosystem. And you have such an incredible, powerful team that is supporting you. And you made some very interesting decisions from the get-go with the way that you structure this documentary. I heard you talking about the choice to approach the storytelling in a very unique way.
Yeah.
First of all, obviously, the choice to use not dramatic reenactments, but rather an actual dramatic story embedded within the documentary was such a unique decision. What made you decide to do that?
Yeah, thanks for your thoughts on that. It was kind of reverse engineered over a period of time. I'm curious, Larissa, I see you smiling. I'm curious. Actually, why don't you kick off that answer?
Jeff is a creative wizard and has wild ideas and many
wild ideas. I agree with, yeah.
and I think, you know, originally we were sitting down trying to understand these concepts just like we would do with a scientist in climate change, and they're so complicated and so complex. And it was really, I think, recognizing that this is just like climate change and that it is an invisible problem. And we needed to figure out a way to make it tangible and to make it visible. And I think Jeff's direction and the vision that he had for this film was always much bigger than a traditional talking heads documentary.
Mm-hmm. Not to fault any traditional talking head documentaries, which I love as well. I think the goal here was really a question of how do you make it as easy to internalize as possible? Because I can hear somebody talk. This is one of the things that, you know, we sit in the editing room for hours and hours and hours on end with countless hours of footage. And you listen to stuff after a while and you're like, I'm zoning out. And you recognize, well, wait a second. We're talking about algorithms. What are we talking about? We're trying to communicate the way that they learn on their own. We're trying to communicate the way that they are personalizing and customizing things for each and every one of us. I can say Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, and we all have an image that comes to our mind, yet there's a completely different version of each of those platforms for each and every one of us. No two people have the same Twitter feed. It's just really interesting when you think about how do you communicate what these platforms and these algorithms are doing to society and to people, how can you make that accessible? And that's what really led to the thinking that created those narratives. We used The Big Short as an inspiration. A huge fan of Adam McKay and what he did with The Big Short, where he took a very complicated subject. He made it accessible through these little scenes that popped into the narrative to help explain things. What we were considering is what's the opposite of that? What's the converse that works for documentary? What's the Big Short version of a documentary film? That's grounded in truth, that's based in reality, that is completely a nonfiction story, yet we can illustrate the concepts as we learn about them and bring them to life. So that was a huge inspiration for us. Inside Out was another inspiration in terms of anthropomorphizing emotions. And yeah. What we were realizing was...
I wondered if that was an inspiration because I kept thinking about the control center and joy and anger.
Exactly. Joy and anger and the different emotions that are at the control center. And that was a huge way to think about bringing these different functions and these different goals to life. And the way we did it in the film is really based on the realities of how many of the platforms operate. We structured it around the three main objectives where there's an engagement algorithm, there's an advertising algorithm, and there's a growth algorithm. And each of these are doing different things in different ways. The systems in reality are far more complex than that. But at the core foundational level, those are the three things that help these platforms create the money that they create.
It's really a powerful image to see that voodoo doll that Roger McNamee talks about in his book. I think he talks about it in his book about Mark Zuckerberg, actually brought to life on screen.
Right. So Roger McNamee and Tristan Harris and Asa Raskin and some others were sharing this analogy with us at the start of the filmmaking process, that there is this avatar-like digital version of you that has been reverse engineered based on all of the input that we give it. Asa likes to say our nail clippings and hair follicles that fall out, like all of the detritus from our digital lives. It sounds really, really gross. And I normally don't reference it because of that. But this notion that the more data we give it, the more accurately it understands us and can reverse engineer us to the point where it knows us better than we know ourselves, which is a common saying in the industry now. It really is remarkable when they were sharing this analogy with us. It was like, well, wait a second. We can visualize this. We can bring this to life. We can show a human interacting with this digital platform, and we can see the platform get better and better at manipulating that person over time, and that the digital model of it is getting more and more accurate over time. And that was something that was just really, really exciting for us to be able to both conceive of and to execute on.
And when you are also looking at all of these different issues related to the terrible effects, the terrible impact of social media on mental health is huge by itself. How did you decide on the balance of the information that you were going to have within the film?
It is a really hard process. There are so many experts and so many books and so many activists and so many insiders that formerly worked at these companies. I think it was a challenge to try to figure out what is the underlying thesis of this film. And I think what we landed on was really this advertising business model, and that without this sort of drive, they're optimizing for our attention, you know, we're now getting all these downstream consequences that otherwise, if that business model may be something else to optimize for the user's benefit as opposed to the advertiser's benefit, we would see a very different platform, a very different social media.
Yeah, it's very interesting the way that that plays out in terms of the documentary and all those things that I listed at the beginning. It's just incredible how you're able to weave all of them through. It's astonishing to me to figure out how you decide, okay, well, I'll take 20% of this content and I'll take 10% of this content. And
in our editor's office, there's a like literally floor to ceiling corkboard, and the countless iterations of story structure that we went through were just mind boggling and really painful. And the countless long hours that our editing team put in to try to puzzle piece all this together was astronomical. I think where we landed, I can sort of summarize the 30,000 foot perspective on the structure where we landed, which took a long time to get there. But the film is structured sort of like with an introduction from the insiders themselves, revealing the companies that they worked at, then going into there's a problem here, but still having a hard time defining it. Then we dive into that problem and identify the business model that is underlying all of it and what this business model is actually doing. And then we go into the consequences and the whole slew of consequences. We started with the individual level ones and then went to the societal scale ones. And that's basically the structure of Act Two, going from mental health and depression, anxiety, self-harm into misinformation, filter bubbles, polarization, radicalization, threat to democracy, and the huge societal, the breakdown of truth itself.
Yeah.
Right. So that's basically like the whole chunk of Act Two. And then we try to wrap it all up at the end. It took like 2 years just to even come up with that summary that I just offered, because it was just such a huge, huge struggle around wrapping our head around like, what are we even talking about here? What is the scale of the problem?
And I'm really glad you provided that, because I was trying to break it down in my head as a writer myself, like what was the three-act structure here? And I couldn't entirely break it down because you did it so seamlessly within the structure of the film.
Thank you. Our creative team will be happy to hear that.
Yes, they will. And
then, well, the challenge there as well, so the real structural challenge for us was figuring out everything there that we just summarized, and then interweaving the narrative elements into that storyline and getting them to work together seamlessly and being able to go back and forth between the two different worlds.
Well, the documentary was still changing. I mean, Jeff would say, right, oh, we've got to interview somebody else, or we've got to, you know, change this scene out. And then all of a sudden, the narrative piece that we have written had to change as a result or move around because the timeline had switched and now the context had shifted.
What was that experience like for you as a producer, Larissa? That sounds pretty...
It was a nightmare. It was a total nightmare. But it was a really fun challenge. And we have my co-producers, Stacey and Daniel, and our production coordinator, Sarah, are just an incredible force of nature. And it really was one of the most interesting challenges as a filmmaking team, because it was working in the intersection between the documentary and the narrative space, and the crossover between that was actually really, really fun. And it was fun for the crew to mix and mingle and see the world of documentary meeting the world of narrative.
And it's such an unusual combination that you never see. And you always see this sort of opposition between the two worlds constantly set up in the film industry. It's incredible that you managed to pull that off in such a rich and rewarding way that serves the purpose of the information.
I think part of it really is just, we look at film as a medium, and there are lots of different things that you could film in lots of different styles and ways. And what does service to the story that you're trying to tell? And how do you best communicate the story that you're trying to tell? And I mean, there are times on this project where we actually debated, should this be a series and go like 8 hours? Or should this be a complete narrative movie, like the exact polar opposite, where do you need the documentary interviews and go full narrative and everything in between? And I think the place that we landed with it being a feature film with these hybrid elements, for me, it really was the right decision in terms of it being grounded. It is a nonfiction film. This is a real, true reality that we're dealing with. And we are able to use visual metaphors to communicate the ideas. And that's really what the narrative stuff is. It's a visual metaphor for what is, you know, hiding on the other side of your screen. And so that was, it was a really, really fun process, as Larissa says, as absurd as our schedule.
A fun nightmare.
Yeah,
fun nightmare,
challenge.
Fun challenges. But I think the team just was eager to rise to the occasion and to put everybody's best in to make it happen.
Your work shows off so clearly. Larissa, you and Jeff have created something that's really powerful here. And I want to let you know that I watched this for the first time with my 76-year-old mother, and she got it. She understood things that I'd been trying to explain to her for like a decade. Wow. She just hadn't understood what I kept going on about when I was talking about Facebook. I mean, she saw The Cleaners and she understood that documentary briefly, sort of. But then she didn't get the connection to the Rohingya in Myanmar, how that has to do with extremism at all. That connection just was missing for her. But your film was able to kind of cross the generational divide to people who are not necessarily users of social media.
Yeah, I think the point that you're bringing up there, this is something that we really wrestled with a lot while making the movie, as news was coming out all the time. And it's like, okay, this scandal, this story, this blah, blah, blah. And what we were realizing was we shouldn't even try to go into those individual news episodes. That's not the point of what we're trying to say here. We're trying to look at like what's causing all of this. What's the foundational structure? What is the generator function that is causing these outputs on society? And it was really looking at it from that perspective, where we kept coming back to, okay, what's like, how do we stick with the big picture and then tie in all these different consequences back to a singular thesis and singular argument? And I think that's in some ways where the strength of the film is, that we were not trying to go into any particular scandal or not trying to talk about any particular actions, not even really any particular companies. This is a collection of different companies that are all operating off of a particular business model, where, and even just the business model is an oversimplification, but it's in my mind, the biggest thing, the biggest kind of thing you could circle that has the greatest number of impacts. The challenge there though, is that these are big problems that are going to take a long time to solve and are very, very complicated to solve as well.
Yeah. And I know this is brand new in the news about the Justice Department's recent decision to pursue Google with antitrust laws. You had different people from the tech industry talking about how regulation and antitrust are the only way to really make an impact and make a dent in any of these issues going forward. Do you think this is likely to be a step in the right direction toward further change?
I'm optimistic if this is a starting point.
Okay.
Right. I think ultimately the antitrust argument, it's one that that our government has been able to wrap their head around from a legal perspective, that they can make a case and start to move forward, but it doesn't actually solve the underlying problems. And that's really where, if this is just a step in that correct, like the right direction, that's where my optimism comes from. I hope we're entering into an era where we see bipartisan concern and prioritization of this as an issue, and that we need to rein in this completely unregulated industry.
And I think similar to the work in climate change, we're recognizing that there are big existential problems and they require change at every level. So while regulation needs to happen, because a number of the insiders in this film, as well as people in the space, don't trust these companies to regulate themselves, that doesn't negate the fact that we also need to look at our own behavior. And we also need to look at the way that these technologies are designed themselves. But I think what we're seeing is that change at every level is necessary, because the onus and the responsibility shouldn't be on the individual. Just like with climate change, you know, I can go to the store and make sure I use my reusable bags and recycle and compost till the end of the earth. But if the system doesn't change and we don't stop making plastic and putting out CO2 into the atmosphere, my little efforts are going to add up, but they're not going to change the system.
Yeah. If the Greta Thunbergs of the world can't actually convince everyone who has that kind of control to use that power for good, what do we do?
I mean, that's where my optimism comes from. I I really believe that there is so much power in the individual, and that in the individual we become a collective. And if we as a collective, and that's what I think hopefully this film and all of the other films and books that have been written about these issues are starting to wake people up to the fact that this is an important issue, that is a foundational issue. As Jeff said, it underlies so many of the problems in our current culture today, that if we all demand action, both at our own individual level and also at the systemic level, then there's actually an opportunity for us to change it. Because just like with climate change, we created these problems. Like, we're humans, and we built these problems, and that means that we have a responsibility to fix them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have another question for you, which is, do you think, and I know this is maybe an unfair question to ask because it might lead you to some humble bragging. I wonder if, because the impact of this documentary has been so huge, do you think that is directly contributing to the fact that so many people are now talking about this Justice Department case and other ways of going after these social media platforms?
I don't think we can take credit at all for the Justice case, not by any means, but I do think this is, as movements are born and gain traction, there have been countless people talking about this and shouting from the rooftops for years now. We're hoping to just add another touch point in a long history of storytelling and activism and work. I think that's how we've looked at our climate work, and I think that's how we look at this project as well. My hope is that for people like your mom that you described, that might not know about the issue that much or might be hearing different things but haven't really connected all the dots, that maybe the film can help offer just a framework for thinking and for understanding, and that they can add up to public demand. And I think that's really what the only way you see real meaningful change is, that the public demands it, and that pressure either is exerted on companies themselves or it's exerted on lawmakers. I think the however we can help put wind in the sails of the people that are doing the work on a day-to-day basis, that's a huge success for the film.
I think it's wonderful. I mean, I wasn't trying to say that, yes, the Justice Department brought the case because of you. I was trying to say that it's gaining more and more public traction and attention because of your film and the work that you're doing to bring so much attention to these issues. Because I think it's really wonderful that you are acting as a translator for these issues of science, for scientists and for helping people really understand what is going on. One of the other things that I really love about the documentary that I felt the need to comment on is your use of core quotes throughout the documentary. I have to say, your choice of people to quote was inspired. I very much enjoyed the whole section that you decided to structure around magic. And then, of course, that quote from Arthur C. Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, which is one of my favorites.
Right. Thank you for that. We were trying to find these quotes that would tie into the subject matter at hand and the particular scene and that particular section. The magic quote, the whole magic frame is just one that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about. Tristan has a line towards the end of the film where, how do you wake up from the matrix if you don't know you're in the matrix? In many ways, I feel like that is the magic trick that this technology has pulled on all of society that we're still in. And we don't realize how we are all being kind of warped through these platforms.
But the other magic trick that I think you pull off within the film is actually making these Silicon Valley types a little more relatable than they would be otherwise by choosing to edit in outtakes of yours and Larissa's interactions with them. Larissa being freaked out by the magic trick, or, you know.
Every time I see a magic trick, and Jeff is a magician. He may not admit it, but he allows some of us to see some of his magic tricks once in a while. And
So that's why that was there.
Magic is, to me, is just amazing, and I think the tie into how our psychology works and how it can be adapted and used and harnessed by people, both good and bad, I think to me was the most fascinating part of this, because really, for me, I am so gullible to magic. I mean, Jeff will do the same trick over. Tristan did that coin trick over and over. And every time I was just floored by it. So I just think that it is something that you don't really think about. You don't think about why magic works and how our psychology is, and the fact that some people do understand that, and they can use that to their advantage.
And it was such a wonderful analogy to use within that frame. And I really was taken aback by it the first time I watched this documentary. Mm. I was like, what? Where's he going with this? I don't follow. It took me a minute to realize the way that you work on so many different powerful analogies throughout the film that really worked so well. But then additionally, that decision to include the personal asides, was that deliberate?
Yeah,
was that
it certainly was deliberate. I'm just thinking through your question and where you're coming from, because from our perspective in the edit room, that was just the most compelling way to share that footage. We had the ability to turn the audio off from the extra microphones or what have you, but it just makes the room feel more alive. You can feel the human connection. You can feel the relatability of these people. Like the opening scene of the film, some of the behind the scenes stuff that we were including was really just to lean into the nervousness that they were feeling.
Yeah. And really that sense of humanity to me makes it a lot easier to identify with their feelings rather than to immediately condemn them for having been a part of this system.
And I think that's something where in some ways we're using that as a way to ramp into the movie, ramp into the scale of it, ramp into just their apprehension going into these interviews. Some of them were very reluctant to go on camera. So then we had to like twist their arms for quite a while to get them to go on camera. And it's one of those things where that's the reality of what those people were experiencing and how they, in some cases, have either misgivings or have been rethinking their roles at the companies or feel a responsibility to share their truth and their story. Those kind of behind the scenes little moments, those in many ways were just like, it's a tonal approach. I think that's really what it comes down to. Like when we're watching the footage and when we're in the edit room, it gives you a different feeling and puts you in a different kind of comfort. It's not an intellectual argument as opposed to an emotional and just like tonal one.
Mm. And I love that you articulated that through the way that you set the tone right off the bat.
Cool. Awesome.
You're making me think about everything completely differently. You're making me admire you more.
Oh,
how dare you?
Funny. Oh,
how
thank dare you? You. I mean, we went through countless versions. I think the opening for a documentary is one of the hardest things to edit. And first of all, I think nonfiction filmmaking, documentary filmmaking, is the hardest part of filmmaking in my mind. You go out there and you collect different materials and you can only work with those materials that you collected, and you can only use other people's sentences and the way that they said them, and you're very limited. It's like you're going out into the world to collect puzzle pieces to try to make a painting, but you're making it through puzzle pieces. And so the process of editing for nonfiction is incredibly challenging. And then the opening scene is one of the hardest things within that, where you're establishing what is this movie about, what's the tone, what's the style, who are the people. Just a really, really hard thing to pull off. And we went through countless different versions. And we started going down this path. We were thinking of it just as like their introductions in some ways, but really it's establishing where they worked, who many of these people are, their apprehensions, their kind of shifting mindsets, and yet still the difficulty to articulate what the problem is. That there are a lot of different problems that people are thinking through here, and there's no easy silver bullet to point to.
Yeah, I was just thinking, somebody made a funny comment online. They said that the assistant editors pulled a fast one on us because they're listed at near the top of the credits at the end. And that was actually intentional, because Dave and Tessa, our two assistant editors, along with Davis, our editor, I mean, it was really a feat to go through the amount of footage. I mean, Jeff wanted to shoot with seven cameras at some point.
Seven.
I think that was, yeah, in each interview. Wow. So he wanted multiple angles to be able to cut between, which I think gives a very specific tone and style to the interviews. But it was a lot of footage to manage, and the media management of that and the editing of it was really quite a feat for them.
So can you tell me exactly how many hours, or is that classified?
You know, it's not classified. I just don't remember.
Dave and Tessa know. I can
ask. Hundreds. I mean, hundreds. We were over 200 terabytes of footage, I believe.
Yes.
Which is a lot. So those are like, we had RAIDs, 8 terabyte hard drives RAIDed together into a box that did 32 terabytes. And then there were like, whatever, 7 of those. We maxed out the number of hard drives we can connect to our computer at a time.
Wow. Well, that's legit. That's legit.
Significant.
No, it's the actual number of hours. The thing is another stat I remember, I think there were 1 million words in our transcripts. So when we broke the it was like in the 900,000 word mark for a while. And I was like, oh, we're not going to break 1 million. And then we did another interview. And then we broke 1 million, I believe, or it was something like that. But it's just we put as much time in as a team. You know, this is 2017 into 2018, when we were really doing the research, trying to figure out who's out there talking about this business model, who's out there that has something to say around like the consequences of this business model. And we were going through that process and meeting a lot of people and starting to conduct interviews. And the interview process itself is sort of an exploratory phase where, I don't know, for me personally, if I look back at the questions that we were asking in 2018, those were genuinely the questions that we didn't have answers to at the time. And now I look at them and like, oh, this has become so second nature for all of us. Like, this is the process of, I sort of think of nonfiction filmmaking is like a PhD course in whatever subject you're making a movie on, because you get to go meet a lot of people and have these in-depth conversations, and then not just have the conversation, but relive the conversation over and over and over again in the edit room. Our whole team, like countless of us on the team, can recite for you the different tone and inflections of different answers to different questions from different subjects, because we've heard it a gazillion times over and over again.
So where are your dissertations? I want to read them.
This is the movie. The movie is the dissertation.
Well, no, I know. Yeah. But like, when are you getting the honorary PhD for the dissertation?
That's out of our hands. That's not.
Okay. Just checking. Mm-hmm. I have to say, the amount of research that you did is really quite incredible. And I found that when I was looking at the idea that Jaron Lanier and Tristan both talk about, which is the idea that there's no shared reality, that there's this problem where no one's connecting on the same level with one universal truth. When you talk about them discussing the same inflections and the same voices on the same topics, did you feel like there was a shared truth and a shared reality on the crew?
Do you mean from the subjects?
No. I mean, like your crew who is looking at this issue, do you feel like when they were exploring this topic, they had this answer sort of fully formed for themselves?
I think it took us all a long time to come to that. I know it took me a long time, because the opening of the film is structured around this question of like, so what's the problem? And then like the difficulty of answering that question, in large part because that was our experience trying to make a movie about this. It's like, what the hell are we talking about here? Like, there are a gazillion problems that we're talking about. The biggest thing in my mind is that we've moved away from a singular tech industry, a handful of companies in Silicon Valley making chips that make computers. That's what it used to be. But we now live in a world where every industry has the opportunity to use technology. And this technology has gotten ever more powerful. And any company or organization could be using algorithms and opaque algorithms and machine learning in a way that the customers or the public doesn't have insight into. So we moved away from a tech industry to all industries use tech. And the scale of the problems is really broad and encompassing. And one thing that we didn't cover in the film is in a broad category of algorithmic bias. So you can see bias and racism embedded in algorithms. There's a book out, Algorithms of Oppression by Sophia Noble. There are countless different ways in which we're seeing algorithms affecting society. And unfortunately, we didn't cover this in the movie, in part because my own awareness of it wasn't significant enough when we were making the film. And there was a lot of learning that happened after we finished the editing. But in some cases, there are the aspects of this problem go beyond the advertising business model that we're talking about as well. So at the time, we were learning about it with facial recognition technology and hiring algorithms and judge sentencing recommendation algorithms. And so we're seeing the consequences of technology in every aspect of society. And it just sort of forces and mandates we need to be going in with the right ethics and the right framing and the right oversight if we're going to make technology and tools that have the ability to affect every person on the planet.
Just like you mentioned the cleaners earlier, I mean, there are other films about other facets of this issue. There's The Great Hack, obviously,
Coded
came out earlier.
Yeah,
Coded by Hack. Coded Bias is an amazing film that came out recently. There's also...
It's coming out soon. I don't think it's actually...
No, it's actually at the Virginia Film Festival right now. I literally just watched it on the virtual...
Festival.
And yesterday. Awesome.
They're going to, I think, have a public release soon outside of festivals. Yeah. So look out for that. And then similarly, you know, A Thousand Cuts, which talks about Maria Ressa and her struggle. So there are just a number of issues that... We need so many stories that, and I think you're right, people are starting to wake up as a community, as a collective, to these issues.
And there are more and more films about the particular impacts on kids and teenagers as well. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. This is like so widely encompassing. The angle that we were trying to offer is looking at that business model. Like, what is one of the main drivers that's causing a lot of different consequences?
But I think you do justice to the consequences. Mm-hmm. I really tip my hat to you for that. And I want to know, though, where you're headed next.
You know, it's when we made Chasing Coral, well, we released it in 2017, we spent months and months and months thinking through, first of all, you're supporting the release of the movie, and then you're sort of starting to think through the next project. And this idea came to us in the fall of 2017. And Larissa and I and our team, we spent months debating, like, do we want to make a movie about this or not? Like, this is not climate change. Like, what's going on? Like, let's do the research. And I feel like we're just starting to enter into that similar type of phase where there are so many ideas that our team is thinking through, or ideas that are coming to the table. In some ways, it's like, what can we do that's going to make a contribution to fill in the blank issue? How can we advance either our storytelling or help shine a spotlight on something that people aren't aware of? What kind of stories, what kind of subjects are people that we want to highlight in the stories that we're telling? So we're asking all sorts of questions, and we've nothing chosen yet. Like, this is going to be an ongoing process to figure out what the next big project is. But the main objective and the main focus right now is just supporting this film and getting this film out and having conversations like this and doing the panels and Q&As and helping people see this technology that we use on a daily basis, but helping them see it in a slightly different lens.
I love what you're doing as a socially conscious filmmaker. And I actually want to ask if there's anything that really shocked you in the process as you were filmmaking that stood out as something that threw you for a loop.
Do you have anything, Larissa, that...
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, every interview...
I mean, I'm sure everything is a unique surprise when you're doing a documentary.
There's so many... And I've thought about this question in different ways, and I've probably used a bunch of different answers every time. But today, the one that comes to mind, we did an interview with Tim Kendall, who worked at Facebook and worked at Pinterest. And we did an interview with him at his home relatively early in the process. And then deeper in, I could recall him going through his own exploration on his thoughts during the interview as we were posing questions to him. And after we finished the interview, many months later, he wrote to me and Larissa and said, you know what, I've been thinking about this a lot more and I have some new perspectives that I'd like to share. And so we did a pickup interview with him, which is one of the very few times that we did that, where we interviewed the same person twice. And it was on that set, after we did that second interview with him, I remember the crew being like, holy crap. Like, I just, like, the response from the crew was, okay, we've been talking about this and thinking about it for a long time, but it just crystallized for them. It was in that interview when Tim was referencing the Civil War comment that's in the movie.
Yeah.
Where does this lead? And his gut response answer on that particular day was that these are polarization machines that will lead us to civil war. And that's what he's worried about. And I think that was a huge, startling wake-up call for all of us who heard him say that in the room. And in the film, obviously, you know, we had to condense and we had to use a smaller part of it. But the full thinking there, just like, it left such a heavy weight on all of us.
I think similarly, when Rashida and Tristan were both giving testimony in Washington, D.C., and we hear from, you know, some of the representatives really asking deep questions about this issue and starting to say that, you know, this this scares me when the electorates of our country are afraid. I think that puts fear in myself as to these technologies really can, if we let them, override the sense of humanity, the sense of democracy that we have in the nation. So I think Jeff is right. It was the reflection of what these people said on our own team that I think crystallized for myself and for, you know, we have changed the way that we live our lives as a result of making this film. We've changed the way that we engage with technology and social media. And I'm really thankful because I do feel like I have woken up a little bit from the matrix. And I think I continue to wake up every day that I read a new book or a new article or I talk to a new person, because it is just like climate change. You don't necessarily see all of the sort of repercussions and the insidious nature of how these changes are implementing and being affected on the way that we live our lives.
Can I ask, how have you specifically changed?
Yeah, I stopped using social media completely, which is not a decision that works for everybody. But I have not been on social media in a couple of years now. And I have seen some of my friends follow suit. And some of them come to me and say, you know, I'm not on Instagram anymore. And I feel really great. Like, I feel like I'm connecting with my family and friends better than I did when I was on those platforms. I feel like there are still members of our team that know about the film and continue to use those platforms. And in some cases, you know, some people say that they need it for work. And I think Jaron Lanier at the end of the film says, you know, I'm not expecting everybody to get off the platforms. And that's not what we need. But we need at least a few people to be outside of the matrix to have a conversation. And for me, I think it is a personal decision. It is everybody has to choose. But again, the onus shouldn't be on us to have to change our behaviors and to turn off all of our notifications and to try to not have the phone glued to my hand every second of the day where I'm scrolling and swiping. And really for us, you know, I now leave my phone outside of the bedroom at night. I listen to Dr. Jonathan Haidt. But it is really surprising to me that we are having to do so many things to undo what we've learned, all of these habits and behaviors of how we communicate and how we share our culture and society, when the fact is, like, we knew how to do all these things before we had all these devices. And there's a whole generation of people that didn't have that. And so I'm really hopeful that that generation will be able to find that, and that our generations that did have that can maybe go back to that a little bit.
I recently did a extended weekend camping trip with a couple of friends, and we were pretty off grid for the whole time. And I was thinking through, when you have real connection with people, like real deep human connection, something like that in a camping experience or getting away from our normal day-to-day lives, that you're reminded of what life could be like and what human connection really is a matter of, and how if you think of Instagram and Facebook as connection, how much you're missing out on this spectrum of human experience, because these are just such, it's like a low bit rate. And that's what's coming to mind right now. It's like such a like broken down, digitized, fractured version of real human life and human capacity. And it saddens me to think that we have a generation of humans that is getting less and less of that, those types of experiences, those types of connections, where in many cases we live a 24/7 connected life now, and your social norms put pressure on you to be active, to respond all the time. And if a friend of yours posts, you know, this is the case for many teenagers, whether it's Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, if somebody posts and you don't respond quickly, mm-hmm. like you lose social status, they lose social status. The whole system that has sort of evolved as a result of these platforms, I'm very concerned about the impact that it has on young humans in the long run. And we've never run that experiment before. And that's just kind of a startling reality that we're entering into now.
I mean, I'm very concerned about it too. I'm a former Latin teacher. I just left the classroom last year, and seeing the effect on all of my students every year, and the way in which they were constantly glued to their phones, and no matter how much attention we would try to provide individually to try to draw individual attention of students back to the matter at hand, it was these devices that the school district ultimately said, oh, well, we're not going to control this because we can't control this. So they have these addictive devices in their pockets all the time that are constantly controlling them. And you see the detrimental effects every day.
One of the screenings that we did at Sundance before we re-edited the film to include COVID, we did a screening with a group of students. And I was actually really surprised because a lot of the students knew a lot more about this issue than a lot of their parents. You know,
They know way more. Yeah. They know way more about this.
We're worried about them, but I think we also should be worried about ourselves. The generation of older folks who are on Facebook and continuing to see the polarization and things like that, they might know about the issue, but that doesn't mean they're not susceptible to it.
Exactly. And that's what I'm most concerned about, because I would find that my students would know all about the ways that Facebook was trying to manipulate them, but they were still being manipulated.
Right. I think that's the thing. A lot of people are like, oh, yeah, it's manipulating other people, but it doesn't manipulate me.
Right. Right.
And everybody loves to think that. And I think for me personally, we've done a bunch of environmental work in the past. And while we were working on this project, we started learning that Russia was pushing out anti-fracking propaganda. And I remember this, one of our subjects, Aza, was talking about this around reflecting his own stance on fracking. And why does he believe what he believes? And that hit me to my core. Why do I think what I think about any issue? I remember back 15 years ago, there were a lot of issues that I just didn't have an opinion on. And now it feels like everybody has an opinion on everything all the time. But what are those opinions based on? A meme that I saw in passing that formulated an opinion? We've created these technologies in a way where we've moved so far away from the value of professionals and expertise who think deeply on a particular issue. Mm-hmm. And anybody can post an opinion that carries the same weight as somebody who did a lot of research on a thoughtful journalism piece. And it's right. just, that's why it goes back to what we were saying at the beginning, the notion of our information ecosystem, like mm-hmm. how information exists and is distributed around the world. That's what is fundamentally changing in ways that do not have any regard for truth or for the values that I think we want in a society that just allows anybody to put anything anywhere. And the algorithms are just going to optimize for certain things, regardless of truth.
Right. And that the trusted sources that we have are given the same amount of space. Like the tweet of a trusted source is right next to the same size tweet of, you know, somebody who is a conspiracy theorist. And they're given the same amount of space and airtime, even though they're really not equal in terms of the content that they're providing.
And then you have an advertiser between them.
Right. And they get more space.
Yeah. They pay for that.
And I would kind of like to draw this interview to a bit of a close, though, by saying that you have the most wonderful core quote at the beginning, though, that illustrates this point that we have this free-flowing information, this vast knowledge at our fingertips, with the quote from Sophocles. Okay, I am a former Latin teacher, so of course that's going to appeal to me. So you chose Sophocles' line from Antigone that nothing vast enters the lives of mortals without a curse. That specific line is actually referring within the play to the gift of the gods, aka Pandora's box, which, let's face it, we've opened.
Right. That's what this feels like. It feels like we've opened Pandora's box and there's no way to close it up again. And we've unleashed these platforms out into the world that have changed the way the world sees itself. And it's just like it feels like a big oops, like in some ways, like, oh, sorry, we destroyed democracy and teen mental health. But we made a lot of money in the process. This is one of those things where it's going to be a hard one to put this back in the box. And even the attempts to do so are going to be extremely difficult. I mean, just Facebook's recent stance on QAnon, and Facebook is trying to restrict and eliminate QAnon content on Facebook now, which is a great thing for them to do, but something that would have been far more effective many, many years ago. And they've allowed it to propagate so much for so long that to respond now in this way feels like it's going to backfire in other ways and in other aspects, unfortunately. And it's just these are really, really big and complicated issues that we're dealing with that unfortunately there are no easy solutions.
I love that you're a Latin teacher, because one of my best friends is a Latin teacher and helped us with that quote. But I think, you know, I have huge respect for teachers and education, and I think that's really what is going to save us. I think with so many of the issues that we face right now, from climate change to the caste system in the United States, I think we need education, and we really need a way for us to recognize and name these issues that we're facing, and a way for us to come together and be able to have a sense of shared truth and the sense of an information ecosystem that isn't bifurcated and filtered and polarized. And so I have faith and hope in humanity, because we have to, in order to get us out of this issue. But I think Jeff is right. It is quite a hefty issue that we have to get around.
But it is that hope that was in Pandora's box too. So
yes. There's hope out there still, somewhere.
There is. Somewhere. So I am so grateful that you are both out there doing the work that you are. And I want to thank you both so very much for taking the time to come by and to talk
Absolutely.
About this wonderful film. I'm so, so happy that it's having the success that it is and the impact that it is.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ariel. It's great to be here, and thank you for your great questions.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening, and thank you to our editor, William Das. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review wherever you found us. Please join us Friday as we celebrate our very first Halloween to the nth degree, with an international panel of female film scholars discussing extreme horror in all its gory glory. Hope to see you next time you ride the omnibus.